Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in cultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. I am absolutely delighted today to welcome Professor Matthew C. Watson to the show. Professor Watson is Associate Professor of Anthropology at Mount Holyoke College, and today we're discussing his new book, Afterlives of Affect, Science, Religion, and an Edgewalker's Spirit, which was published in 2020 with Duke University Press. Professor Watson, welcome to the show.
Hi, Adam. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit about the genesis of this book?
So it's nice to have an opportunity to talk about the book. It's been a real passion project for me across the past few years. It has a long genesis. It was in the making for a long time. I wrote a dissertation in 2010 that was a science studies-based approach to the history of Maya hieroglyphic decipherment. So I was a graduate student who turned from archaeology to the history of archaeology. I had done some undergraduate work in archaeology and some undergraduate work in cultural anthropology, and I ended up working in my graduate career with a Mesoamericanist archaeologist and historian of archaeology, Susan Gillespie, who pointed me to the history of Maya hieroglyphic decipherment as an area that was sort of understudied in terms of critical perspectives on the history of anthropology, right? There's been a lot written about Maya studies, and Maya studies is very important to the development of U.S. anthropology, but there hadn't been a lot written about hieroglyphic decipherment. And at the time, I was working through theoretical perspectives in my coursework as a graduate student, and perhaps one of the most consequential courses that I took was a science studies seminar, an anthropology of science seminar with Stacy Langwick that introduced me to a new way to think about epistemology, a new way to think about knowledge. And I was thinking about historical knowledge through other frames and other kinds of perspectives and trying to get a handle on how to think about the history of Maya studies. And I decided at the time in conversation with Susan and others that it would be exciting to think about the history of Maya hieroglyphic decipherment, something that unfolded mostly in the 1970s and 1980s, though it continues today and had precedence before that. Thinking about this moment, this much lauded, touted moment in the development of Maya studies through a science studies lens. What happens if we take the ideas of thinkers like Donna Haraway and Bruno Latour, Andrew Pickering and others, and apply these kind of systems-oriented, complexity-oriented perspectives to an object of knowledge that's not exactly science, right? That was in many ways on the margins of science, right? So Maya hieroglyphic decipherment started in art history, development in the 1940s, 50s, 60s in art history, and by the 80s was a linguistic practice. So it sort of scientized itself in ways, in the ways that many 20th century disciplines that turn to language and linguistics do, right? So I was thinking about hieroglyphic decipherment through the lens of science studies as this field of knowledge on the edge of kind of humanistic and scientific thought. And what I found as I got into this, I was sort of working through the history of Maya studies, Maya hieroglyphic studies, or epigraphy, as it's sometimes called, through archival work and through some ethnographic work. And I found this very small, bounded community of experts who by the 90s had become deeply invested in enshrining their own internal history of their field. And what I was trying to do was sort of to kind of break open their own narrative of self. What does it mean if we tell a different story about the history of the field? This is why the work to me felt like and is ethnography and anthropological, right? I took an object that was very close to the world that I was coming from in anthropology, but I wanted still to defamiliarize it in ways and to tell a different story, to tell a story that wasn't just reiterating the narrative within Maya studies. And the narrative within Maya studies about decipherment really takes the developments of the 1970s and 80s with the precedence of the work of a couple of scholars, Russian and American before them, as these fundamental moments and tells a story of a progress, this clear progress up to this moment of a kind of scientific revolution in the decipherment of Maya glyphs. So they talk about this kind of earlier history in which all of these scholars got pretty much everything wrong. And then by the 1970s or in the 1970s, all of a sudden they get everything right. And I wanted to understand how they got everything right or what it meant in their own ways of thinking to really understand in a fundamental and deep way what ancient Maya writing is. And at the same time, so I'm taking these science studies perspectives. I'm also, as a graduate student, my last 2 years of graduate school, I taught six sections of introduction to linguistic anthropology, a fall, spring, summer, fall, spring, summer. So I was writing my dissertation and teaching an intro language, linguistic anthropology course, coming from a place where I had some semiotics background, but not a deep understanding of linguistic anthropology at the time. And I was becoming attached to some of the ideas in linguistic anthropology, like Michael Silverstein's construction of language ideology, perhaps most centrally. Other perspectives too. Michelle Rosaldo's critique of speech act theory was very valuable to me. A critique that's pretty rooted in ideas about language ideology, an argument that the way we think about what language is determined by our own systems of attitudes and systems of beliefs. So I was coming from a perspective that was rethinking the history of anthropology, archaeology, art history through science studies, influenced by language ideology, challenging the internal narrative of what Maya hieroglyph experts advocated at the time. So I was opening up those problems, finished this dissertation, assembling the ancient public science in the decipherment of Maya hieroglyphs, and published some articles out of that work, some science studies-based work, a piece in American Anthropologist, and a piece in Social Studies of Science that are very science studies works, right? The piece in American Anthropologist looks at these workshops on hieroglyphic writing from the 1980s that were held at the University of Texas, Austin, and the way that the teachers of those workshops, including the figure who becomes central to my later book project, Linda Sheely, cultivated in a broad public an attachment to ancient Maya glyphs, an attachment to the idea of deciphering them. And I published a piece that was on a controversy over the age of death of a 7th century Maya lord, Pakal, in Social Studies of Science, which is a controversy a piece. There's a tradition in science studies of looking at scientific controversies as spaces where the implications and underlying cultural, norms of scientific practice, of science in action, become exposed, become more obvious, right? So I was doing those kinds of studies and working from a position that was pretty critical of the politics of hieroglyphic decipherment. Hieroglyphic decipherment is a part of a broad institution of Maya studies that's deeply attached to both systems of funding in the United States. Big funders like the Rockefellers and the Carnegies funded, you know, early mid-century Maya studies because they had economic interests in Mexico. I was trying to think about this from a perspective that told, you know, this other story. What if we think critically about the ways that these scholars coming from these highly funded major U.S. institutions, what if we think critically about how they reconstruct the ancient Maya and what the consequences of that are in the political present? There's a tradition in Maya studies of thinking along those lines, you know, running back to at least the 1980s, a light critical tradition within Maya studies, but it is itself a pretty bounded community. So I was working out these problems and trying to think carefully from a science studies perspective about what Maya hieroglyphic decipherment was. And I made these arguments that through language ideology frame, to some extent, not as technically as the real linguistic anthropologists, but I made these arguments that this is a kind of reduction of Maya writing. Right, that the beliefs that epigraphers, hieroglyph experts have about writing are pretty different from what ancient Maya scribes 1,000 years ago, right, thought about what they were doing. Right, so I tried to say this is a kind of, and I did argue that this is a reduction of a complex aesthetic form that is both art and writing to a particular narrow set of ideas about what writing is. So I adopted what one might think about as a somewhat paranoid position, not a conspiratorial paranoid position, but a strong theory, right? Challenging some of the terms and political implications of hieroglyphic decipherment, which ramified throughout the political worlds and the economic world of tourism within Mexico and Guatemala, and I think not always to great effects, right? To complex ambivalent effects that post-colonial science studies is keen to pick up. So I was working through those problems. I was writing this critical work, and I was reading experimental ethnography, and I was reading in affect theory. I was finding myself taken by the works of thinkers like Eve Sedgwick and Katie Stewart, and started to ask myself about 2012. Whether it might be more valuable to write an experimental and weak theoretical, to use that term. There's strong theory and weak theory in parts of affect studies. Affect studies advocate sometimes that we work from weak theory rather than a strong theory that determines our objects, but instead that kind of feels ethnographically or otherwise with the texts and people that we think about. So I was trying to think with some of their ideas about affect, to think about how decipherment itself was a site of affect, of heightened affect, right? So I started to think about these amateurs, the public that Linda Shealy drew in, not from the position of trying to critique decipherment, but from the position of trying to follow the amateurs into their spaces of heightened attachment to Shealy and to the ancient Maya, right? And that's what really motivated me to write this book. Some of the early writing was also in conversation with kind of the limits of animal studies. The first chapter that I wrote was published as an article first in Cultural Critique, The Animal Anthropology of Linda Shealy Spirits, which becomes Animals in the book. And it's an examination of this core figure, this artist and art historian, Linda Shealy, through her attachment to the companionate rabbit, an animal spirit companion, her appropriation or adoption of a quasi-Maya ways of thinking about attachment to animal others through a spiritual frame, a problematic one in ways, but also a very sincere set of practices in terms of kind of reconstructing her artistic and critical self. So I was thinking with her and about the limits of animal studies by thinking with her. And I found her to be a really extraordinary guide, to offer a different set of ideas than what I had taken from her work before. I had photographed her letters. So Linda Shealy died in 1998, and I photographed her letters at the table of her widower's home. Which was quite an extraordinary experience as a graduate student. It's a different experience than most archival research, right? Because most archival research takes place in archives, and this was actually like working with somebody's personal papers in a private setting. And I became increasingly attached at about 2012 to following Linda Shealy into the world of the ancient Maya in what I think is a more low theoretical, sincerely ethnographic frame. So the purpose of this book was to write a kind of experimental ethnography that centered Linda Shealy as a figure, as a charismatic figure within the field. So she drew me in, and this book was my effort to contribute to, I think, a world that she helped to create.
Maybe there are some listeners who don't know who Linda Shealy is. So maybe could you give a little bit of an introduction to Linda Shealy?
Sure. So Shealy was an artist first in terms of her professional trajectory. She was from the suburbs of Nashville, Tennessee, and born in the 40s. And she was a surrealist painter. She briefly tried to pursue a graduate career in literary criticism, but found it to be, in Linda's words, nitpicking bullshit. And Linda became kind of returned after that brief graduate stint to her undergraduate institution, the University of Cincinnati, where she finished an MFA in surrealist art. She was a biomorphic surrealist painter. Think of Miró or Klee. She was employed as a painting instructor, assistant professor actually, at the University of South Alabama. Her first job out of graduate school was at the University of South Alabama. And because of her proximity to Mexico and connections that her husband, David Shealy, an architect, had with archaeologists working in Mexico, she began to travel to Mexico. So she went to the Maya area a number of times in the early 70s. She traveled to a particularly important ancient Maya site called Palenque, which is in the northeastern corner of Chiapas, in 1970. And there she encountered another artist, Merle Green Robertson. And Robertson had been trained as a landscape painter, a Western landscape painter, but had become an art historian and had set up shop in Palenque, where she was working on producing a corpus of rubbings of the iconography and inscriptions, architectural inscriptions. So she was working with a particular technique that involved reproducing inscriptions through rubbings. And Linda Shealy came to apprentice with Robertson. She came to work very closely with Robertson at Palenque. And she became enamored with the ancient Maya, with the romance of the ancient Mayas, which is an old story, cutting back to at least the 19th century and travel writers becoming enamored by the romance of the Maya archaeological sites and artifacts and architecture. So she became attached to this kind of site of Palenque in ways that were at once historical and, in some sense, as my work starts to think through in this book, a pretty religious set of attachments or a pretty spiritual set of attachments. So she was working with Robertson. She wasn't thrilled as a painting instructor at the University of South Alabama. And she, in the late 70s, decided to pursue, after she'd already established herself in the field, through a series of roundtable meetings, these public workshops in Palenque and some publications. She pursued a PhD in art history at UT Austin. In the late 70s, got it done in just, I think, 3 years, and then started to teach Maya art history and Maya studies at UT Austin. There she founded this series of public workshops, originally called the Workshops on Maya Hieroglyphic Writing and later called the Maya Meetings, that became very popular in the 1980s. Right. So Sheely was teaching a broad public who were attracted to the kind of romance of the ancient Maya, how to understand the writing system in ways that really cultivated in them or kind of diffused in this public audience a sense of heightened affect, a sense of profound excitement. Right. So Sheely was this animated figure herself, a very charismatic teacher and professor and scholar and thinker, right? So she drew around her this large kind of community of everyday people with all kinds of jobs coming from all kinds of corners of their lives who chose to spend their vacations by traveling to Austin for a week every spring to participate, or a few days and then later a week to participate in this workshop. And they developed a community around this workshop. She became this very compelling figure within the field. She wrote a series of popular books, Forest of Kings with David Friedel and Maya Cosmos with David Friedel and the writer Joy Parker and several others that really synthesized popular writing and scholarship. She's remarkable in this respect, that she was writing these books that were at once popular. And if you read the footnotes of Forest of Kings, they're making pretty original, profoundly original at times, scholarly claims. So she was producing through these workshops and these popular press books, a community of devoted amateurs around the world of ancient Maya writing, decipherment, right? So she became this popular core of the field in the 1980s, as it was in some ways professionalizing. She has been called the last amateur anthropologist, which I think is kind of silly because they're still amateur anthropologists, amateur Mayanist, Maya hieroglyph expert, amateur epigrapher. So she wrote these popular books. She had these popular workshops. She played an integral role in transforming Maya studies broadly, in drawing from the work of Mayanist epigraphers like Evan Vogt, an argument that the Maya had for thousands of years retained this core kind of set of cultural beliefs, right? A pretty dubious argument from an anthropological perspective, but one that was persuasive and compelling to an audience at that time. So Sheely became this very charismatic center of the field, and she tragically died at age 55, died young of pancreatic cancer. She died in 1998. My work started, on this project a little less than a decade later, to think about what the kind of public world and the scholarly world and the social world of ancient Maya studies and Maya hieroglyphic decipherment was.
And in this, the title of the book is Afterlives of Affect, Science, Religion, and an Edgewalker's Spirit. And you've touched on this a little bit without actually using the word. Can you talk about what edgewalking is?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, it's fun, but also hard for me. Edgewalker is Sheely's term, right? She called herself an edgewalker. I'll pull the passage if you don't mind if I read a passage. She said in a documentary that's called Edgewalker, made about her and released, if I recall, after her death. She says, there are people who are centralists and there are people who walk on the edge. And I think it's the edgewalkers that continually push the box and push the shape at the edge. And I think they're the people that make fields change. I've always deliberately chosen to be an edgewalker, knowing that my work is going to be wrong. But I also change the nature of the field and change its directions and get other people to take on different kinds of questions that I would never be able to do if I was a centralist. So here in this kind of documentary produced at the end of Sheely's life, she's contrasting her own work as somebody who came into art history and Maya studies from the position of being an artist first, also a woman, right, in a field that was dominated by men. She was around other important women, Merle Green Robertson and other important women art historians. But the dominant forces in Maya studies remained deeply masculine. Archaeology was a deeply masculine space at that time. So Sheely, and I imagine, I'm not a historian of art history, but I imagine that art history was as well. And she's thinking about herself here toward the end of her life as somebody who was willing to take risks, was willing to be wrong, was willing to push the boundaries of a field, was willing not to reproduce its center, but to approach it from the edge, to approach it from the margins. I think it's hard not to think about Austin when you think about edgewalking. Austin in the 70s and the 80s, late 70s and the 1980s, the kind of really weird Austin. Like she had come from a place, you know, that wasn't the center of Maya studies. Centers of Maya studies were, you know, places like Harvard, and to some extent Tulane. You know, there were these institutional centers of Maya studies. And Sheely was not of them. She was an experimenter. She was an edge pusher. She was a risk taker. And she was willing to be wrong. And I sort of love this willingness to be wrong. I think that anthropology at its best is willing to be wrong, is willing to take risks and willing to be wrong. And I think it's also really, there's a moment in the book where I call anthropology, because some of this book becomes a kind of meditation on anthropology. And I call the book The Amateur Science of Marginal Magic, right? And I think about Sheely as being this this kind of lover of the ancient Maya. Amateur comes from love, right? From amare, right? This lover of the ancient Maya who was willing in very popular books to push the boundaries of argumentation. I'm writing these days about Evan Vogt and the Harvard Chiapas Project. And there's a letter from Vogt, who is a real institutional center, kind of central figure, to Maya studies, at least, my ethnography. And there's a letter that he writes to Sheely and Friedel about one of their books, I think Forest of Kings, and says, you know, I'm not sure if these arguments, if some of these arguments are going to stand the test of time. But they are, it's profound that you've argued them, that like Levi-Strauss's work, they are willing to take the risk of pushing the boundaries of knowledge, of trying to undo the staid conventions that we adopt as disciplinary thinkers, that all of us, I think, in our institutional socialization into fields, right? Sheely was trying to unsettle some of those ideas. And some of this is a hyperbolic triumphalist narrative that the Mayanists were spinning. But I think when one really digs down into what Sheely was doing, I don't think that when she calls herself an edgewalker, she's being insincere. I think that she really felt herself somebody who was not quite comfortable in the worlds of Maya studies and art history, and that she was thinking about the art and artifice of that work. She remained an artist. If you read her interviews, she doesn't come at history or knowledge or myth or language from a position that's overdetermined. She comes at these problems as somebody who's like, who's a bricoleur, who's a creative thinker, right? Who's just kind of working with the shreds and patches at hand and trying to make a story, to tell a story, right? She understands, as an artist, she understood the artifice of scholarly work. So I think edgewalking is about understanding the art and artifice of our work. I think edgewalking is about the willingness to be wrong, the willingness to take risks, the willingness to push against the centers of anthropological or other disciplinary attitudes, and the perpetual ongoing value of experimentation. I think anthropology these days sometimes suffers from taking on too many core ideas that are widely understood on a certain level, or like topics that are on the front page of the New York Times, the political topics of the day. And that's important work. Those are on the front page of the New York Times for very important reasons. But at the same time, anthropology gives us this license to experiment with the world, to tell a different story, to work in the margins of the world, whatever those margins might be. Those margins might be very distant from the geopolitical centers of scholarly work, or they might be right in the middle, right? You know, right in some edge in the middle, some hole in the middle of our own scholarly work, our laboratories, our conversations, etc. Right. So Sheely really inspired a lot of people to think about how I think on some level this was a creative and social project and that we ought to think as we do scholarly work about the creative social world that we are also constructing. I think a sensibility that centers, or that I guess you can't center it, but that draws on a notion of edgewalking is one that is self-aware in its own critical sensibility. And unlike, I don't want to speak with too broad a brush, but unlike some of the more narrowly linguistic thinkers that mostly have followed Sheely, some of whom have been very consequential thinkers and have done very interesting things and have been awarded for it. But unlike some of these big stars of the Maya world who follow Sheely, like Steve Houston and David Stewart and others, Sheely, I think, thought about this as an open public space of really kind of pushing the boundaries of the way that we think. Right, not just a narrow story about what a particular sign in a particular glyph means, which is what most of the Maya epigraphy literature looks like. It's incremental, but it's at a very, very like narrow scale or small scale. Right, the kind of work that decipherment is piecemeal, incremental. You decipher sign by sign. It's a slow and tedious and difficult task. And what Sheely made of that world is a deeply social, incredibly heightened set of attachments among a lot of people, who some of which were looking for something to attach to, right? Who really needed something to animate them. And so she produced a very weird Austin and, you know, world of the ancient Maya, of people attached to the ancient Maya. So that's me walking around the notion of edgewalking, which is perhaps all I can do.
Speaking of telling different stories, now we've talked a lot about Sheely, but this is not a biography of Linda Sheely, as you mentioned very clearly in the book. Could you describe for listeners what you're doing here in Afterlives of Affect, and maybe talk a little bit about the form of the book?
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Thanks. So, as I said, this is a somewhat experimental book. I call it a person-centered experimental ethnography. It's hard for me to compare it to other person-centered books, but of course, in that space, I'm thinking about Zhao Biel's Vita, centered around Katerina, a patient in a mental asylum in Brazil, that takes very seriously some of the ways that Katerina thinks, and I think about the work of Warwick Anderson on Carlton Gajdasek, a history of science that's person-oriented, very storytelling, that's engaged in following a particular scientist and amateur anthropologist into a world of biomedical science, but that takes one through quasi-ethnographic work in New Guinea. So I'm thinking alongside some of these kinds of experimental, semi-experimental works of person-centered ethnography and history. And also I'm thinking alongside the affect theorists and experimental anthropologists. And there's a really important tradition of experimental anthropology and a lot of interest in invigorating experimentalism and kind of play with ethnographic form today. Excuse me. So I started this project by trying to kind of break out of the somewhat more conventionally written mold of my science studies work. And in 2012, I wrote the Animal Anthropology of Linda Shealy's Spirits essay, which really took me into thinking with Shealy about Maya studies and thinking about how I might write this story very differently. Right. So I wrote this experimental chapter that critiqued some of the turn to the animal in anthropology, thinking with Linda Shealy's own spirit companionship. And I then wrote a piece that was a couple of pieces, which are in the book, the chapters Sacrilege and Cosmos, early chapters in the book, which are written in vignettes. Sacrilege is certainly written in a nod to Katie Stewart's Ordinary Affects, though it takes obviously a very different kind of object. Rather than thinking about the kind of post-industrial anime of the United States, like this, Sacrilege thinks about the what it is to engage with the dead, what it is to think about and think with the dead. And here I'm thinking about what it means for me to write an ethnography of someone I didn't know, right? Of somebody who died before I took an anthropology course, right before I took an anthropology course for the first time. I thought about this as a kind of elegy, as a turn in my work that would open up this experimental way to think about forms of attachment. I think that experimental ethnography sometimes can be really distant from the world that it's evoking, right? I'm invested in a notion of evoking a world, but I also want to evoke a world richly. I want to evoke a world that feels like an ethnographic kind of experiment, right? And I think that what I was trying to do was to take the pieces I had, the fragments I had of Shealy's life, some of the letters that I had, and to form those into a kind of evocation of her social world, of the world, the social and epistemic world that animated her and gave sense to her work, right? And to do that, I found myself kind of breaking from conventional forms. I was very grateful that Cultural Critique was willing to publish this experimental piece that I'd written, and it gave me hope that I could write a book that was as much engaged with questions of form as it is engaged with questions of substance or the kind of critical position that it's honing. And the book is written in a series of different styles. Sacrilege, the first substantive chapter after the introduction, is written in this series of vignettes that evokes the archive that I was working with. I wrote Animals and Cosmos early. Cosmos was originally written as it was originally called 6 Degrees of Carl Sagan. And it was written as 7 short vignettes that are person-centered and that trace out the connections between Linda Shealy and Carl Sagan And Lynn Margulis, who was Carl Sagan's first wife, and Dorian Sagan, their son, thinks about how Sheely had a connection with Sagan, and how Dorian Sagan at that time had kind of entered into conversation with anthropologists around some of the philosophical questions that we were asking at that time. And I was on a panel with him at the AAA, and I had this encounter with Dorian at the AAA, where he was the culture at large speaker, the Society for Cultural Anthropology's distinguished speaker. And at that when he was at that conference, the AAA, Lynn Margulis had a stroke. So I was thinking about the connections between Sagan and Sheely, Carl Sagan and Sheely. And I met Dorian at this conference, and I was influenced on some level by his work and by Lynn Margulis's work as well. And I was just thinking about how my object had imploded. Right. Like I was trying to use the ideas of thinkers who were kind of systems thinkers influenced by Margulis and people like Isabel Stengers and to use their ideas to make sense out of Linda Sheely's world, her world, and David Friedle's world. And here at the AAA, the strange ethnographic moment of the AAA, where these worlds are colliding and Dorian was working through the sickness or the stroke and the eventual death of his mother, right? So I was thinking about the Linda Sheely and thinking about what it means to write about the dead and to live with the dead and to attach to the dead. And I was seeing this other side of my project, this more theoretical corner of the work that I was doing as struggling with the same or working through the same kinds of problems. So there was this implosion. And I wrote 6 Degrees of Carl Sagan. And don't tell the folks at Duke, but nobody wanted to publish it. No journals wanted to publish it. And my wonderful, wonderful editor at Duke, Liz Ault, who's an extraordinary person and was a great guide into like how to make an experimental book happen. Liz said, well, you know, this piece was evocative, but it didn't quite know what it evoked, right? And so I built the piece out in a sense. And so if you read Cosmos, up until there are these three asterisks in each of the section. And the original form of that chapter, this is the key to the chapter. The original form to the chapter is that it has an experimental vignette in each section, followed by the kind of extrapolation, the explication that I wrote years later in order to make it into a real chapter that somebody would publish. So I was playing with form through this period. I was thinking with folks like Stuart, not actively, I don't know her, but more direct colleagues who were engaged in experimentalism, Stuart McLean and others, Anand Pandian, that kind of corner of an experimental ethnography, and thinking about what would happen if we did that, not with the kind of conventional objects of ethnographic knowledge, but with the social world that surrounded the ancient Maya through Linda Sheely. So those were the initial experiments. But each of the chapters actually reads a little differently in terms of its form, structure, and style of experimentation. Some of them are more scholarly. Some of them are more playful. Not that I would ever hold those as opposed.
Yeah, I'd like to zoom in maybe on one chapter. In chapter 5, maybe you could introduce listeners just generally to chapter 5 before we get into some specifics.
So chapter 5 is titled Genius. It is a kind of exploration of the idea of genius. Sheely was called a genius by a number of her colleagues. And I was attracted to that idea. Not because I have some grandiose notion that there is such a thing as a genius, right? But because I think what we do as ethnographers is to take seriously what people say about the world. And if the people around Linda were calling her a genius, if people like Gillette Griffin, who was an art curator at Princeton, called her a genius. The chapter starts, I think, with Gillette Griffin calling her a genius and others, I think Andrea Stone, and Griffin saying that he was friends with Einstein and he gives Linda Shealy the intellectual edge. I wanted to explore what it meant to think about Shealy as a genius. And I was immediately drawn to the ways that she was attached with other kind of big thinkers like Carl Sagan. They corresponded to some extent. And I was drawn to some more passing correspondences between Shealy and Levi-Strauss, Claude Levi-Strauss, who wrote Shealy and some of her immediate colleagues to laud their developments in Maya studies. The fact that they'd taken this body of inscriptions that scholars for decades had thought about as maybe not being writing. There are arguments about whether it was writing at all. And the most popular position in the 50s and the 60s, owing to J. Eric S. Thompson and Sylvanus Morley and other kind of old dons of Maya studies, was that this was a body of astrological, you know, rebuses that were used by astronomer priests in their own kind of astrological thinking. And some of those inside Maya studies say that Thompson was trying to think outside the horrors of World War, which he'd seen. They were using this as a kind of space to project their own fantasies of a utopic other world that's more peaceful than the horrors that they'd experienced. And Shealy and her colleagues instead build this other kind of world, and she's taken up as this profound thinker. But I struggle as an anthropologist still with taking seriously the notion of genius. So I use the connection between Shealy and Levi-Strauss to think about whether this is in fact a really valuable internal myth within ancient Maya studies, right? What we're talking about is this kind of this work of bricolage, as Levi-Strauss calls it, right? This creative work with the shreds and patches at hands, with the received signifiers and signifies, the terms that we get in our everyday life, we stitch them together. There is no truly original thought. There is no truly original idea. Everything is kind of bricolage. And Levi-Strauss and later Derrida are pretty invested at moments in thinking about the opposition between this kind of work of bricolage and the work of kind of totalizing knowledge, the scientist or the engineer opposed to the bricoleur. What I wanted to do was take seriously the Mayanists' myth of decipherment and myth of genius, or story of decipherment and story of genius. And I wanted to take it seriously by kind of working Shealy and Levi-Strauss's ideas together, taking my central text of Levi-Strauss in that chapter is his introduction to the work of Marcel Mauss, which is one of Levi-Strauss's, in my reading, I haven't read all of the Levi-Straussian corpus, but in my reading, it's one of his stranger essays and one of his more fascinating essays. And it's the essay that becomes this cornerstone of Derrida's and other post-structuralists' thinking. In Structure, Sign, and Play in the Discourse of the Human Sciences, Derrida takes this idea of the engineer and says, this is a myth of the bricoleur's making. So what happens when we think with the Mayanists who are studying ancient Maya myth about the myths that they're telling, that they're storying about themselves. I don't get so technical as to be engaged in a structural analysis of anything, though I edge toward it at other moments in my work. But I wanted to take seriously Levi-Strauss's reading of Mauss as a truly remarkable essay that thinks about how Mauss's work on religion is not a distant critical work. We tend to read, if you read most, the book you're most likely to read is The Gift, right? And the book that is that sticks in my head in a way that undoes how I think is really General Theory of Magic. General Theory of Magic is the text that introduces, I think, the idea of mana. Also is engaged with the idea of how these oceanic concepts that Mauss is drawing, you know, into French sociological thought. He's thinking abstractly about mana in particular. And Levi-Strauss is attached to the way that Mauss is not just thinking about mana, which is an oceanic term for a sacred impersonal force. Right? And it has all of these different meanings and all this kind of ambiguity to it, this built-in ambiguity, right? So what Levi-Strauss does, perhaps one of the most fascinating things that I find in that piece is that Levi-Strauss thinks about Mauss' reading of mana as an enactment of mana, as an extension of mana, that Mauss himself is caught by the sacred force of mana, that what he's doing as he thinks about and tries to rewrite the way that people think about magic in this text that is kind of an ethnological, like a 19th century ethnological text. It reads as much like 19th century ethnologists as anything, right? It's generalizing, it's grand, it's big, and it bigger than The Gift in terms of its scope. But Levi-Strauss sees clearly that Mauss is extending the magic of that he's describing, that there's this performative quality to the analytical work that he's doing. And Levi-Strauss, you know, says when we think about what mana is and mana does, we are thinking about this floating signifier, this term, right, that has a surfeit, an excess of meaning, right, that can't ever quite be pinned down. And Levi-Strauss here says we need this excess of meaning in order to be able to even communicate. Right? That when I say God and you say God, we mean something different, but we can still communicate through that term, right? So a floating signifier is this glue that keeps language and really language in its communicative interpersonal performance. It keeps it working. It enables us to have this conversation, right? The words that I say mean different things to me than they mean to you, right? But certain terms really have that profound range. And really for Levi-Strauss, following Mauss, organized thought. And so I'm thinking with Mauss that mana, that to write about, you know, these kinds of ideas is to continue them, is to enact them. So I'm thinking about what it means for Scheele to kind of build on and draw on these classic Maya concepts that are, you know, very different from their context of use, right? When she writes about the why, the spirit companion, or when she writes about the closely related idea of the how, the Lord, or any of these like core terms that they're working to decipher and struggling to decipher, what they're trying to do is to partake of a reconstructed version of that ancient Maya world. So Levi-Strauss helps me to think about that continuous effort to reconstruct a world that came before us and to which we are indebted, whether it's a reinvention, as is the case in something like, you know, so-called decipherment, or whether it's our continuous work of memory and transformation of the world we have around us through the terms we have at hand, right? That this is not a series of oppositions, a series of external analyses, but instead this kind of continuous process of reimagining. And once you think down that line, I think once you follow a Levi-Straussian, early Levi-Straussian logic, it's not hard to start to think about how this is a spiritual or religious practice, right? A practice of hermeneutically receiving ideas and transforming them into something new that we offer to those who come after us, of taking the floating signifiers that we have around us and offering some sense to them with the knowledge that others will find a different sense. So I think about Levi-Strauss and Scheele together here as similar kinds of thinkers and thinkers that had a brief contact. I'm fascinated by a moment in Levi-Strauss's introduction where he reads the floating signifier in relation to a kind of divine speech and understanding, something that I think hasn't been fully kind of worked out. And I'll leave it to those who are more dedicated to the history of structuralism than I am to work out some of those implications. But I find it very, very exciting to play and think with. So that was a rambling discussion of the chapter, but that it circles around some of those ideas and the myth of genius.
It's absolutely brilliant. This book is such a thrilling read. It's so wonderful. There is one tradition on the New Books Network that I like to uphold at the end of all my interviews, which is, what are you working on now?
So I am continuing to work in the history of Maya studies. I'm becoming perhaps a bit more historical these days in terms of the way that I'm thinking about the history of anthropology. And I'm, you know, through my work on Scheele and hieroglyphic decipherment, I became pretty interested in the work of ethnographers in Highland Chiapas in the mid-20th century. I'm finally, starting in 2017, I finally began archival work that was on the history of my ethnography. Particularly, I'm writing a history of the Harvard Chiapas Project, which I mentioned Evan Vogt earlier as an influence on Scheele, who kind of drew on a certain tradition of Maya studies to make this argument that the community of Zinacantan on the outskirts, or the neighbor to San Cristobal de las Casas in Chiapas, that Zinacantan was this closed corporate community, what you know, Eric Wolf and others call this closed corporate community. And I'm interested in how Vogt came to that community. He was from the American Southwest, New Mexico, and he'd done work in the Southwest. But in the mid-1950s, after getting tenure at Harvard, he turned to ancient Maya studies, was invited, or contemporary Maya studies, excuse me, Maya ethnography. And he started ethnographic field work and a huge ethnographic field school in 1957. The field work in 57, the field school started in 60. So I'm writing right now about the relationship between the Mexican state and Harvard anthropology in the 1950s and the 1960s. Mexican anthropology was transforming at the time. In the 1940s, after the Pátzcuaro Conference of 1940, which introduces a notion of indigenismo, pan-indigenous thought in the Americas, and gives a kind of anthropological charge to Latin American states. The Mexican state in 1948 establishes the Instituto Nacional Indigenista, the INI, and they go to Chiapas and they work as a quasi-settler colonial project to draw the Tzeltal and Tzotzil speakers of Highland Chiapas into the Mexican state, into identification with the Mexican state. At the same time, or shortly thereafter, some of the major figures in Mexican anthropology invite Evan Vogt and some others, they're Chicago anthropologists working in Highland Chiapas with the Man in Nature Project. So they start these what will become major, huge ethnographic collaborative projects, right? And they have this kind of complex, ambivalent relationship to these Mexican development administrative officials, some of whom are anthropologists, one of whom is Alfonso Villarrojas, who worked with Robert Redfield in his classic work on Chancón earlier. So I'm writing about the relationship between the Mexican state and Harvard anthropology. in the 50s and the 60s. And I'm thinking about how the Field School instituted ideas about the neutrality, including the cultural neutrality of method. Starting to think about whether it might make sense to make an argument about ethnographic method as being this, you know, some of the kind of critical thinkers around race in anthropology call a white public space. Whether the kind of training in ethnographic methods, the kind of scientific neutrality, the objectivity that it cultivates in students I'm thinking about whether it's an understudied part of the history of anthropology and what it might mean to start in big, by looking at the history of anthropology in big collaborative fieldwork projects, and also thinking about method rather than thinking about theory. So much history of anthropology is about the history of ideas, history of theory, maybe a little bit of social history. But right now I'm writing, I just wrote an essay that's about the relationship between the ENI and Harvard. And I'm writing an essay right now about Evan Vogt's first major purchase for the fieldwork project, which is a Land Rover. He bought a Land Rover off-road vehicle in 1957 when he started the project, because Chicago had one and he wanted one too. And so I'm touching like a little bit of the automobilities and a little bit of the infrastructure literatures to rethink the history of Maya ethnography in the highlands of Chiapas.
Wonderful. The book is Afterlives of Affect, published with Duke University Press in 2020. Professor Matthew C. Watson, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Adam. It's been a real pleasure to be able to join you today.